This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and today we're joined by Julie Green, the author of a wonderful new book. It's called Motherness, a memoir of generational autism, parenthood, and radical acceptance. The book is a beautifully written, compelling, and relatable memoir that draws you in immediately to the challenges and joys of autism, providing valuable insights to parents of autistic children, adults who've been newly diagnosed or are questioning their place on the spectrum, and anyone seeking a greater understanding of diversity. And as Anne Douglas wrote on the front cover of the book, this beautiful quote, I wanted to share it, "Motherness is all about loving the child you're raising and accepting the parent you are. A fiercely honest and wildly compassionate memoir. I loved this book," she writes. And I echo that. So did I. Oh,
thank you.
I was actually surprised how much I took to it. Didn't expect the kind of reaction that I had all throughout. I was captivated. I cried quite a few times, especially at the end, laughed, and was so absorbed in their world. And yes, as I said, I had a full-on bit of an ugly cry at the end.
I always feel strange when people tell me that. Sorry.
It was just so wonderful. And I actually listened to the audio version of the book, which was excellent, by the way. And I highly recommend that to people who are looking for another kind of experience. I sort of read along with the book, but it was lovely to have the audio version. Before we meet Julie Green properly, let me tell you a little bit more about her. So Julie Green is a Canadian author with a background in creative writing and English literature from Concordia University in Montreal, my hometown. She later moved abroad to London, where she spent the next 10 years before relocating to Toronto following the birth of her child. In 2024, she was a finalist for the CBC Nonfiction Prize for her writing and has appeared in the Washington Post, Globe and Mail, HuffPost, Parents, Chatelaine, CBC, Today's Parent, and more. She also writes The Autistic Mom on Substack. Her memoir, Motherness, a memoir of generational autism, parenthood, and radical acceptance, is a number one bestseller in disability biographies on Amazon, and it's been nominated for a Forward Reviews Indies Book Award. Congratulations on all of that.
Thank you.
Motherness is a funny, unflinchingly honest, and deeply compassionate memoir about Julie's experience with raising a child with autism while discovering she herself is also on the spectrum. It's an inspirational story that speaks to the great challenges and the great joys of autism and one of radical acceptance. Julie currently lives in Kingston, Ontario with her husband, teenage son, and old English bulldog. In her spare time, she runs a women's book club and volunteers at an arts center for adults with developmental disabilities. Julie Green, congratulations on all of this and, of course, on this beautiful book, Motherness, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss.
Thank you. Wowee, that's an intro. No stone left unturned.
Well deserved, well deserved. As I mentioned, I loved your book, Motherness, and the way it traces your journey from childhood to early motherhood, whereby you had to advocate for your son while navigating your own struggles. Your diagnosis of autism came 10 years later. Your intensely personal account of what it's like to be autistic is all the more rich and authentic because it's through the lens of both you as the mother and of your child. And I know you wrote for many parenting magazines before this, but can you tell us what ultimately inspired you to write Motherness? Can you tell us a little bit more about your brainchild?
Sure. Well, I think it's so strange. It's kind of a phenomenon as well that a lot of people are realizing they're autistic through their kids. So particularly women. So a strange thing, this sort of great reckoning happens when this happens to you. In my case, I was 44. So you end up looking back in the rearview mirror your entire life and looking at this thing that happened, this thing, you know, your school experience, your prior relationships, all these things through this different lens and going, aha, oh, that makes sense now. Or that's what, it's this sort of, I guess, strange postmortem process of analyzing everything. And I mean, I've always written to process things anyway, whether it's fiction or poetry, because I was always bent on a creative side, or essays. I mean, I wrote essays for years. So for me, naturally, I started to kind of take all that analysis and write about it. Hmm. And I think at one point I just thought, you know what? This is actually, it's very cathartic for me, obviously, to process and understand things in this way by writing. But I also realized that this is a bigger story than me. This is happening to a lot of people. And they're really kind of struggling to make sense of it. And even on the flip side, there were so much of my parenting years, I guess, you know, as they say, in the trenches, especially in the early years, where I was just treading water and really struggling to help my son and figure out what was going on with my son. There were so many things that I had never really processed about those years as well. So writing just became the way to do that. So I ended up writing, I guess, the book that I wish I had had when I was a parent, very confused, very isolated and alone. So that's part of the genesis for writing Motherness, that I think eventually, I think it always with memoir, maybe I shouldn't say always, I don't know, I can't speak to other people, but I think it starts out as this intensely personal thing, which it has to be. It's really, really intimate. It's very personal. There are undercurrents of a more universal story. And even though the details are different, so many people have contacted me and said, oh my gosh, this is my life. It's not my life, but the emotional journey, so many people have really felt seen and they really relate to that, even though obviously the specifics of our lives are completely different. So that makes it very worthwhile. What's incredibly daunting, to be honest, because you're putting so much at the time too, I was not really thinking about that. You put so much personal detail and so much raw information on there, but I think it's worth it when you realize that you are connecting to a bigger story and one that I hadn't seen out there. I hadn't read, I'd read a lot of autistic memoirs by autistic advocates, usually who are like in their 20s or a bit younger. Obviously, there are a lot of books by parents with autistic children, but I had never seen anything that kind of married the two.
Yes.
So that was that was kind of the impetus in eventually deciding to make it a full book project.
Yeah. I'll tell you what's interesting, because I'm not the mother of an autistic child, nor am I autistic. We have relatives and definitely people in our lives. But I felt universally it spoke to me as a mother. Mm-hmm. The pain, the joy, and all of it. And I'm going to get more into that as we go on. But I just think this is also a book for all mothers and for all people who want to understand the joys and the heartbreak of being a mother. Because there's stuff that was just so poignant and it resonated so deeply that I thought, wait, does she know what happened that day?
You know, I don't have psychic powers, I swear. I've even heard from people who aren't parents, which is really strange because, yeah, I wouldn't have necessarily expected. But you're right. I mean, that's why we read memoir generally. It's not because we relate to the human emotion. You know, I can't relate to an immigration story or someone who's going through a war or like a terminal diagnosis or abuse or different things. But that's the beauty of memoir, because I think it really just speaks to the human experience underlying things.
It does that really brilliantly. It really does. And I also loved the way you divided each chapter into the different parts of what it's like to be autistic, talking about like a chapter on sensory processing, meltdowns and shutdowns, masking, empathy, alexithymia, bullying, elopement, special interests, disordered eating, gender diversity, twice exceptionality, and more. You tell your story of how your son Carson was diagnosed with autism at age 3, and you interweave your story as well, along with research and facts, and it all flows very seamlessly and expertly to create a very vivid picture of what it's like for both you and for him. And I think it sort of takes place from the time he's a baby until he's 13 years old. Yeah. And I found it very compelling when you write about reading that 10-page report about Carson's diagnosis. Can you talk about what that was like when you had to read and digest this report about your son as you're sitting there and taking this all in?
Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of a twofold thing. In one sense, it's extremely overwhelming and scary and sad. But on the other hand, there's also like an aha moment, just as there was for myself, of thinking, okay, well, that explains it. I'm not just a terrible mother. This, I haven't imagined that it's been hard, that it's been intense. And of course, when it's your firstborn and you don't have tons of experience, you tend to, I think a lot of women do this, any difficulty, when you're a first-time mother, you automatically, instead of thinking, oh, I wonder potentially if there's something going on with my child, you automatically think, no, of course, it's whatever I'm obviously doing as a mother. I'm doing something wrong. You know, I think if it's maybe your third child and you think, oh, hang on, the other two weren't like this, something might be up, rather than right away jumping to internalizing it. But that's what I did right away. So in a sense, having someone confirm that, okay, there were some differences and there were some things you weren't imagining it. And it wasn't because you were totally doing something wrong as a mom.
Totally. Absolutely. That's incredible. And I was going to say, on some level, was it something you already knew about yourself when you were diagnosed 10 years later in your 40s? Was it almost like an aha moment and maybe a relief to finally have it out there? Oh, that explains my situation, just like I had that aha moment with Carson. Was it sort of a relief?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people say there's some grief as well because you think what things might have been possible. But I didn't feel a ton of that because I think I was a product of an era where even if I had been diagnosed younger, the world didn't know what it knows about autism today. The supports wouldn't have been there anyway. So I don't fault my mother for not, you know, people didn't know what they didn't know. I'm happy to know now because obviously it informs how I treat myself now. It informs how I advocate for myself now. So I do very much feel like better late than never, but I don't kind of blame because it was just a product of a different time. Even with my son, even going back, he's 17 now, but even from now to the time he was young, things have changed so much. So obviously I probably would have done some things differently, but we were in a different time then as well. And everybody does the best they can within the social construct and whatever help and things are available now. So I'm hoping things are better for kids now and better for late diagnosed adults. I just feel it's good to have that information. So yeah, in a way I was like, I was relieved because I knew all of these things about myself. I knew I'd been diagnosed with anxiety and depression. I'd been treated for them. I'd had all these chronic migraines that had no real cause. I mean, there were a lot of piecemeal things that were blamed on other things. I talk about in the book, she's an only child. So she's very difficult and rigid and set in a little bit sort of compulsive about certain things. And when she's just very shy, and that explains. So there were all these sort of piecemeal reasons that I guess kind of explain things, but not the whole picture. So essentially, I just grew up thinking, well, I'm clearly weird. And, you know, why are you like this? Why do you do this? Why do you do that? And again, not having a real understanding of it, you just internalize it and think, well, I'm weird. I'm a freak or whatever. We internalize other labels. If we don't get the right label, the world makes up other labels. And we are very good about internalizing those, unfortunately.
Yes. Yes. Wow. That is incredible. I just think it's so good that there's so many people that experience this. And what you're doing with this book is going to help so many people feel less alone and less weird. And it's kind of normalized. And your book is helping a lot of people, I'm telling you. The face of autism is changing. We're hearing more and more women about women finding out that they're neurodivergent later in life. And even here in our bubble here, my associate producer actually went through something similar, being diagnosed with ADHD in her late 30s. And she described how even small things like holding a conversation and being confident in her responses suddenly became easier when she started taking medication. And In your book, you do say and describe things that haven't been talked about as much in these personal accounts and memoirs of autism, like aggression, like taking medication, things that people would just not even when they're writing about it, not go there. And by going there and being so authentic and real and raw and honest, you're giving permission for other people to be the same and to not have shame and to not have all that nonsense. Because this happens to so many people. There's more people, I think, that might be having this condition than not. So can you speak to the whole idea of how we're hearing more and more about it and how you really weren't afraid to just go for it and just really talk about this, honestly?
You know what? I think it was a moment of madness. I think there's a disconnect when you're actually doing it. And, you know, I'm kind of just that person too, though. I'm obviously very honest. And I just think there's no point unless you're going to be fully honest. But there was also this disconnect that maybe I didn't think, you know, one day this is actually going to be out in the world and like random neighbors are going to go, oh, you know, I read your book, or, you know, my friend's husband came up to me and said, I feel like I know you so much better now. And I thought, okay, this is getting a little bit weird now. But at the time, you know, it to me was just like, if you're going to do it, you have to be 100% authentic. Otherwise, there's no point. I just didn't feel like there was a point. And as I said, those were things that I experienced and felt incredibly isolated and alone. Even within the autism community, I felt like we were kind of cut off in some ways. And that was an important process for me to even just unpack that and write about that. But definitely I wanted other people who were going through that to read about that somewhere, because, you know, if nobody writes about it, then nobody talks about it. They say this in the book, then nobody talks about it. Yeah. And then, you know, if nobody's talking about it, then you really do think you're the only one going through this. And it's not good. It's not good for parents.
Julie, did you feel a sense of catharsis in doing it, like in writing it? Was it cathartic or difficult?
It was cathartic, but I think the important thing is, for me, I mean, and a lot of writers say this too, you need a decent amount of time to pass if something is going on in your life. I mean, you can't really write about it without having that distance. So I think enough years had passed for me to just have that buffer emotionally. But obviously, you know, I'm really painting these scenes, so you do very much go back in there. But I think it's actually really healthy. It's cheaper than therapy.
You're so right.
But also, I very much did things to safeguard. I changed my son's name in the book. I also was very selective about the things I did share. There were some situations and things and incidents in life, his life, that I didn't share. I was quite selective about, I did share some really difficult things, but there was also a lot that I left out. So it's not just a case of a no holds barred. She's just going to overshare and tell everybody everything, which is strange because people then read the book and they're like, oh, I know everything. Well, you know, kind of, it's still,
you do, but you don't.
It's still like a kind of, I won't say manicured because it's not embellished, but it's still a very curated thing.
Yes.
So,
yes, that's incredible. There's also this longstanding misconception that autism means a lack of empathy, but that's really not the case at all. And I actually know of someone, a young person, who showed greater empathy for a grief I was experiencing than anyone else in my life, really.
I'm happy to hear that. Sing it from the rooftops, please.
It really was the case. Yeah. Like, my father had passed away, and this young man, when he found out, cried and said, you must feel really sad. He just said it and really felt it more than anyone else who said, oh, I'm so sorry. And all the things that people say, and they're well-meaning, but his was so pure and genuine and empathetic, really empathetic with a capital E. So can you speak to empathy, Julie, and what you've come to understand about empathy through your experience?
Yeah, insofar as I understand it, there are kind of two types of empathy. So I won't get the wording correct because it's been a little while now since I've done all this research, but basically one type is the type of empathy that you actually feel and experience. So it's more emotional, and one is how you show it. So autistic people, according to research and studies, actually have the exact same expressive and emotional experience of empathy. It's just sometimes we don't sort of get the cues, or we don't express it in the sort of socially conventional way. It can either look like we don't say the right thing, or there's a delay in processing. So maybe it sort of hits us later. So from the outside, it might look like, oh my gosh, they're so callous, or they have no empathy, but it's really just, we're not showing it in the right way or at the right time. And I've sort of felt that my empathy was just kind of out of whack, really. Like sometimes it would be like, I'm feeling too much and more than other people, or I'm feeling too little, or I'm not showing it at the right time in the right way. So it just feels like we're not really doing it the right way by the world standards.
Yes.
But scientifically, we actually do have, it's just one of those really harmful myths. And in fact, in some cases, with I think a lot of women in particular, we are showing like hyper empathy. So, and that's something I often experience. I mean, there's a whole other book there, which I'm really interested in animals and our relationship. Autistic people, you know, sometimes have this very strong attachment to pets. And our grief can sometimes look really, it's really disenfranchised. And I've had this experience where I lost my dog, and I have found people just staggering, like asking after like a week. So we sometimes are like, it's just our relationship to grief and that empathy piece. Sometimes it goes the other way. And I think, what, you know, we're not talking about this in the right way. So I think for autistic people, sometimes we're feeling too much and we feel ashamed. We feel like we have to not show things, or we have to perform grief or empathy in a certain way. And that's not to say we don't experience it at all.
This is reminding me a little bit of a moment in the book. And I just want to get to it, where your grandmother, Nan, passed away. And I want to get into your grandmother because she was a profoundly important person in your life. And you didn't cry. And yet you felt such deep grief and sobbed when your dog, Rosie, died. What did that experience reveal about yourself and about, I think it's connected to everything you're talking about.
Yeah. I felt tremendous shame, honestly. Obviously, I also didn't know I was autistic then. I didn't understand the things about grief and empathy that I do now, but I felt deeply ashamed. I thought, like, what the heck is wrong with me? Am I a monster? I know, and I knew, like, obviously, she was like a second mother to me. I was deeply connected to her. So why was I not showing that right response in the moment? And if anything, I was also kind of doing the mirroring thing you were talking about, like the young man. I was crying because my mother was crying, but I wasn't in touch with my own feeling then. And I've noticed later that I did process that loss in a different way and kind of on a different timeline. But again, in society, if you don't show this and perform this in a certain way, then you're really shamed for it. And I think that's unfortunate.
That's such a good take home. It's just you're processing it in your own way and it's coming out at another time. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there was a time many years later, whenever it was, where it just hit you and the grief was there, but it wasn't, you know, and people have to understand that it's just a different time. You've said it so beautifully. You had such a close relationship with your grandma and Nan growing up, especially with your father not being present. You say in the book, Father John, like a ghost, haunted your childhood. It's almost like Nan's presence and his absence shaped your sense of self growing up. And you paint these wonderful scenes of driving around at night together with Nan, Kenny Rogers singing in the background, stories unfolding about Nan's romantic spirit. I love this, being drawn to cowboys and her penchant for farmers and truck drivers. And what did she teach you? She was a romantic. She loved love. She wanted to be in love. What did she teach you about love? Because I think you're a very loving human.
Oh, thank you.
A very loving mother. Mm-hmm. What did she teach you about love in her own unique way?
Well, she was very cynical about the romantic side of love because she'd loved and lost lots of times. But I think she was a great example in that her kids were everything. She loved her kids really staunchly. And no matter what trouble they got in or as adults, whatever they needed. And she was just so funny. Like, she was a bigger, larger than life. Like, I've written about her before in the Globe as well. I wrote a piece a few years back. And again, see, that was like after her death as a way of processing. And I wrote this nice piece, like kind of as an homage to her, but it was just, it took its time kind of germinating. But she was not a saint. Like all humans, she was really complex. So she loved fiercely and was a great model for that. But someone said to me once afterwards, like, do you think she was autistic? And I'm like, ooh, spanner, wow. Maybe, who knows? She had really debilitating anxiety. She definitely had a lot of difficulty with certain social relationships, but she absolutely was very, very direct and spoke her mind. So as a result, yes. She had a lot of enemies and she had a lot of friends. So she could either charm you or really just turn you. So she could be really, really, you know, she was very loving. And obviously I loved her so much, but extremely hurtful.
You say, I got the feeling that Nan really says it like this. Yes. And once she said something that didn't feel right about your son, Carson, yeah. And even though it hurt you at the time, she was often right. Yeah. How did that land for you looking back?
Yeah, she was right. She was obviously very rough around the edges, but she knew babies and she knew children and she picked up right away having only met him. She died not that long after he was around and she knew something developmentally was different. She spotted that long before any doctor or daycare worker could flag that. So, and you know, no mother wants to, everyone gets defensive with the best possible intentions, but yeah, she absolutely was right. She'd love to know that.
I had a grandmother like mm-hmm. that too. I had two grandmothers and the grandmother that was really sort of tough, really did say it like it was Grandma Jean. And sometimes it really hurt, but it often was exactly right. Yeah. I really relived so many things mm-hmm. that were so, so relatable. Friendship is a very compelling theme in the book. And one that I found deeply poignant. You talk about your friendships with Carrie and Jess and Stephanie. And of course, you ricochet back to those friends when you talk about Carson's friend, Ella. And my heart broke when Carson made this friend, Ella, who took Carson under her wing. And Carson was this angel who was lovely to everyone, very popular, angelic being. But ultimately, she felt smothered when Carson was so enamored with her and wanted to be with her all the time. Because he's a real person and he liked her. So he wanted to hang out with her and she wanted to be friends with everyone. And in the end, she kind of broke his heart. There's a line where you write, I wear my child's suffering like it was my own. That was like a spear in my heart and in any mother's heart. Can you describe what that was like for you to watch that hurt and then how it reverberated some of your feelings about your friends from your childhood?
Don't answer that just yet. We're going to go on a short commercial break. We'll be right back. Back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We are back on Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio. I'm Judy Liebrack, and I'm here with Julie Green, who's the author of this wonderful book called Motherness, a memoir of generational autism, parenthood, and radical acceptance. Before the break, we were just discussing a theme that shows up in the book, and that's friendship. And I was asking you, Julie, if you could describe what that was like for you, watching Carson and Ella and the heartbreak of feeling left out. How did that reverberate for you and remind you of some of your own feelings from your own childhood?
Yeah. And maybe that's what it is too. I think everything our kids go through, whether it's the joys, it's all just like sort of mirroring and echoing our own joys and our own rejections. So I think when he experienced a rejection, it was like, I felt all the things that had happened to me on the playground, which is, I guess, interesting the way I've structured the book, because I am running so many things in parallel, because I'm trying to compare things that are similar about his experience of autism and then the things that are different and similar to mine. So I do a lot of diving back. But I think absolutely this is what we do as parents. There's no you and me barrier between us and our kids. And I think often that's why a lot of parents get into the trap of wanting their kids to be great at sports or at a certain thing, is because they kind of want to relive that joy for themselves. And we sometimes forget they're distinct people, because we really, we feel that stuff. And I think, obviously, my son always struggled making friends. And so hearing that there was this first little friend at any point who was really inclusive and open to him when other kids may not have been. But of course, him like not getting it right because missing the boundaries and having to learn these things, which is something all kids have to learn, but it's especially hard with autistic kids. And then obviously the result of that, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but obviously did not work out. So
that was a heartbreaking scene in the book. And I also had such an intense reaction of feeling compassion for you, Julie, when you talked, and relatability to it, when you talked about wanting to provide colorful chalk and those bubble wands, bubbles, to everyone in the neighborhood to help make friends for Carson. And one day he pushes one of the girls, I can't remember if it was Olivia, but one of the girls in the neighborhood, the mother's right there. And I wrote, where does she come from anyway, that mom? And suddenly the fun is all gone, right? Like the bubbles, the fun is all dissipated. And everybody disappears one by one. And that's the last day that they come and congregate on that small front yard. And then when you talk about later in the book, watching them play with joy in their faces through the window pane, through your window pane, watching them all outside playing together without Carson, I just lost it. I couldn't stop crying. Trigger warning, everybody. Read this book, Motherness with a Box of Tissue, Kleenex.
But there are funny things too. Don't worry.
I love that you said that. There's lots of humor. And
depress people too.
No, I have lots of the humor and the music and all the fun things coming up. But this just drew you in because it was so real. And every mother has experienced something like this at one point or another with their child. There is, you're right. There's a juxtaposition of, there's a lot of humor in the book. I have to say that.
Very deliberately, because I did not want it to be a total downer, because it's not. My son is hysterical. So there are always funny things happening. So I definitely didn't want it to be like the tragedy.
Yes.
I wanted very consciously to push away from that narrative, which unfortunately is coming back in a lot of circles. And it's just not accurate. It's not how most of us live and experience autism in our families. It's hard.
Yes.
It's absolutely hard, but it's also fun and funny, and it's everything. It's complicated.
It's complicated. Yeah. It is complicated. I'm going to jump to the happy things. It's true. There are so many happy things and humor, and there's so much, and his whole comedy thing, which we'll get to in a minute. But the music, I loved when you discovered your mutual love for music. And I know you've always loved music, Julie, and Carson. It was hard to find things in common. And then he discovered the Beatles, and how he knew everything about the Beatles, and how he found the repetition so soothing, comforting, and collecting trivia about the Beatles. And I love when you write, he was so passionate about the Beatles that you write, and I quote, it's like he's seeing the face of God. He's in ecstasy and rhapsody when he listens to the Beatles. And the title of that chapter is When I'm 64. What was it about the Beatles that Carson loved so much? And then can you tell about how you start to OD a little bit on the Beatles?
Yeah, as they say, too much of a good thing. And this is what happens, because when autistic people get into something, they don't just like, don't get into it lightly. They go really hard and really deep, and it can last years or it can last months. In this case, it was pretty much a year. I would love to know what it is about the Beatles. I think just generally, there's clearly all these decades later, there is something about their music that still just hits each generation, and people just click with it. I have no idea. And I know there's an autistic contingent that really latches onto it too. So it wasn't just Carson, not just me. I would love to know what it is. There's some magic that they had and that still gets people, right? But you're right. After a certain point, and we've had this with every phase and interest he goes through, that even for me, there came a time where it was like, you know what? Can we just pause the Beatles for 5 minutes? And of course, at the time we had the Sirius in the car, the satellite radio. So we had the actual Beatles channel. So it was wow, just nonstop all the time, to the point where, yes, I was driven half mad. But I'm happy to say years have gone by. He no longer even listens to the Beatles. He's moved on to teenage things. So now I can happily go back and I can listen to them again. But there was a time where it was saturation point. Yeah. But like the whole book, you're right. Someone told me this book is like love letter to Gen X. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I did that. It obviously will land with people of a certain demographic just because of all the references. I can't help it. I kind of live in song lyrics and that's sort of my world. So I'm always just dropping in these things. And this is a funny thing too. I actually made a playlist for this because I realized some people do this now. They make playlists for books. I don't know if you're aware, not just, so it's like a soundtrack for a book, but there were so many musical references in the book that I thought, oh, this is going to be fun. I'm actually going to make a little playlist. So if anyone's on Spotify, if you search Motherness, listen to it while you read or see if you spot the references, because almost everything is linked. It was just a fun thing for me to do as I was writing.
That's so great. And there's so many references, like we'll talk about some of the Peppa Pig. We don't have to go into it, but you have to read to find out what I mean by that. But it's so up to date and it just resonates. And you're right, it fits into pop culture and all the rest. I also loved when you discovered that Carson was funny, and even more so when the principal of his school noticed that Carson was funny and got Carson to add a joke every day on the loudspeaker in the morning announcements. And then he gained this popularity, the sudden popularity. What was that like for you and him? That must have been such a good feeling.
Yeah. Well, it's so nice because it just right away, you can see when someone believes in your kid or sees the best in your kid, there's this internal glow, and it really boosted my son's self-esteem. And it's just, we give educators such a hard time, but there are some really amazing, we've come across some really horrible people, but some also really amazing people who've really gone to bat in ways that they didn't have to. Like, they've really gone above and beyond for Carson and for our family. So, you know, I was like, I have to give a shout out to a couple of these people because, you know, there are people out there who are, unfortunately, who just really don't get it. They aren't doing things that are inclusive for our kids, and they're really not helping. But there are other people who are absolutely amazing.
I was going to say the couple in the basement really struck me. In the class in the basement, there was this couple. Wasn't that a wonderful example as well? And the principal, and there were many. And it was juxtaposed also by
a French teacher. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And there's so many things. I could just go on and on because there's so much. There was another very painful thing in the book, which to me has to be spoken to, which is the meanness of some people and how you invited those girls over. And you were worried because they all had swimming pools. And you thought, oh my God, I don't even have a pool or a father at home. And it's an apartment, it's a smaller home. And they went upstairs and you had cleaned your room a million times to prepare for it. And it really, oh, that was hard. And they did a makeover on you. And you thought you were going to look like the Young and the Restless stars, and you wanted to look like them. And I related to it because I'm dark also, and they're all blonde. Yeah. And you wanted to look like these blonde Young and the Restless stars, like Nikki Abbott. I could just see it.
That was the day, right? And, yeah, I'm speaking to a time, because there was a time when, you know, little girls had to be pretty. You had to be blonde and blue-eyed.
That's right. And they went and they put on the makeup, and you kept saying, can I see it? Can I see it? And then they finally showed you the reveal. And of course, it was horrifying, and it wasn't great. And you were devastated, and they left. And didn't even have the snack. And this just speaks to, I mean, this is a universal thing of teenagers being mean.
Oh, this was little school. This wasn't teenagers. They were younger. Yeah, we were young.
Oh, well, that was brutal. Yeah. And then you rocked and you sobbed. Yeah. And what do you take from that story? What's the lesson for people out there? Because that was just, like, Ella was actually a good person. She got it. She didn't end up being perfect, but she kind of got it and did some good things for a while. They just didn't get it.
Well, they were not. A lot of kids are mean, right? And a lot of kids, I've seen some kids just be amazingly inclusive and supportive of differences. And they're seeing it, but have been extremely welcoming. And a lot of parents were extremely welcoming and inviting us for play dates and asking to help. And we did have a lot of people, but it's like life everywhere. We also had some really, really rotten interactions that just made my blood run cold. People who really just weren't thinking for a second that, what if this was your child? Just really making my child out to be a monster. Really heartbreaking stuff, but that's the world, right? I think we do the best we can, hopefully, to expose children and to teach them not just tolerating difference, but that you can be friends with anyone and everyone's a human being, essentially. So it's not just about, oh yeah, be nice to that kid because he has whatever. And I think that's also just a problem with our society at large when it comes to awareness. And it's not just about tolerating people. It's about genuinely just including people because we're people.
Exactly.
Everyone has stuff to offer, not necessarily in this capitalistic society, but we're all human beings and we all have dignity. But yeah, some kids, even when there's no neurodivergence or disability at hand, some people do fall to the hands of bullies. Yeah. So I think that's why some of those scenes are super relatable to people, because I was just reading Margaret Atwood's biography, and of course, Cat's Eye, the whole book is about her and these mean girls in middle school, which tends to be a really bad time. So it was like, that's echoing that as well, right?
Of course. Of course. There's also many people that I think you had in your life. So there was Nan, but there was also Mitch, the step-grandfather, who was your stepfather, but was very kind and good. And I also wanted to talk about your husband, Aiden, and how you complement each other perfectly, because he's a big part of this as well.
Yeah, I have to backtrack because someone said to me recently, this younger one, she said, I need an Irish Londoner. He's just perfect. I said, no. I think I may have put him a little too high on the pedestal. He's not perfect, but we're kind of perfect together. We've ironed it out and we make it work and we really balance things out
nice
with each other. But yeah, blessed. I'm like, no, nobody's perfect. Did you read the book? Nobody's perfect. But no, he's great.
It's great. And you did this fabulous renewal of the vows. And I always think that's a really important thing to do in a marriage. And I love that you went to Vegas and you noticed this Elvis impersonator coming in to help achieve this. And of course, that reverberates for another part of the book that I want to get to. But what was that like? And what's the secret to your marriage? Because a lot of people, when faced with difficulty, it goes one of two ways. You get closer or in many cases, you fall apart. It doesn't work. It ends up breaking up the marriage. And you had an opposite situation. So there's got to be a secret there that maybe you could share with our listeners.
I know. I've actually just been asked this question by a reader of my Substack too, because I think it's in particularly in families where children have a disability. It, like you say, it's either make or break. It either sort of the adversity and just not the adversity of the child, but of all the things you have to do to support a neurodivergent child in an ableist world. Honestly, there's so much advocacy and it's relentless. So that either will bring you closer together, or the stats are sadly very high for divorce. Secret, I think really... trading off. Aiden is also, he's ADHD. So I think the fact that we are both extremely direct communicators, there's no trying to read each other's mind. We're very direct, but that works for us. So yeah. The communication, absolutely. And we have always prioritized having some time together, which is definitely really difficult when you're in those more intense phases of parenting. But we always tried to get a respite worker or a family member or something, even if it's just we'd go to a gig or we'd go for dinner, something, or even just something at home, making sure when Carson went to bed that we would connect and try to set aside that time. Because it's very, very easy, especially in the really intense years of parenting, to lose sight of each other. And there were definitely harder points that kind of coincided with the harder times that Carson was having, where it felt like we were just living and breathing this. And we'd almost set ground rules sometimes, like, okay, for the next half hour, we're not going to talk about Carson and what's going on with Carson. We are just going to kind of take a breather from it, because it can get so all-encompassing trying to talk things through. And you have to, obviously, but you have to just not lose sight of the reason why you're together. And we just very much act like a tag team. When I'm having a hard time, he takes over. When he's having a hard time, I say, oh, you need to go for a walk, or give each other the space. And I think because we were together for, we were married even 8 years before we had Carson. So because we've been together for so long, I think he is very, even before I was diagnosed, he was very in tune with the kind of supports and stuff that I needed without even calling it autism. Like, he just had this sense of like, okay, wow, you're getting overwhelmed, or you're getting sick, or whatever, and giving, kind of supporting me through that. So it's not like this point keeping system, which I think sadly a lot of couples fall into, but it's like, yeah, just remembering it sounds very cliche, but there's no way around it. But it is, I picture us being like a relay race, which is how you have to do it, because parenting is super intense. And we're lucky. I really honestly don't know. A lot of people are doing this solo, and it is really, really hard. Yeah. It's really, really hard. Yeah. Even when you have two very, very committed parents, it's hard.
Yeah, for sure. But how blessed are you?
Yes. Not going to take it for granted. Yeah.
It's really awesome. The story of Elvis, of course, I was saying, mm-hmm, reminded me of the moment in the book where Carson has facial blindness and hugs the Elvis impersonator as a little kid because he thinks it's his father. And so that's another important thing for people to understand. We're not going to explain that story. There's so much in here. I just found it all. The descriptions are vivid and powerful. And you write so beautifully that it really helps the reader get just immediately be drawn into this world inhabited by these characters. You feel like you're part of the story. Like, I love at the retreat. I love this part. I'm going to tell a bit of it. Okay. When you're at this retreat, you say what you really needed was a spa, a stiff drink, and a massage. And that wasn't quite what you got. There was a lot of hugging, which makes you uncomfortable. And you got sucked into it because, as you say, you're a people pleaser and you couldn't say no. I'm not going to let you answer because I do want people to read that story, but that story is fantastic.
What's so funny is people come back to you later. My friend from that scene then comes back to me. I'm so sorry about that retreat. Like, don't worry about it. She's like, I had no idea. I said, I had no idea, clearly, at the time. Don't worry. But it is so funny, these people who sort of come back to you later and feel like they have to make amends. There are no grudges.
Totally. For someone listening who might be in the thick of it right now, the real thick of it, they've just gotten a diagnosis about themselves or the diagnosis of their child, what would you want them to know about autism spectrum disorder? What is the greatest golden nugget you'd like people to take away from your book, Motherness, a Memoir of Generational Autism, Parenthood, and Radical Acceptance?
Ooh, I would just say your child is still the same child who's in front of you. Just staying connected with your kid is honestly the most important thing. So you won't necessarily say it, but they will know if you're feeling those barriers to accepting them and loving them for who they are and enjoying them for who they are. Because everyone, whether they're non-speaking or anything, they are all their unique people, and they're all worthy of love and connection with you. It takes a little while, obviously, to maybe get your head around that new reality, but I would just not focus on trying to change your child. Focus on, obviously, supporting them where they're at so that they can have the best possible life.
Yes.
But they're not going to be some other person. So meet them where they're at and just really enjoy them. I wish in Carson's younger years that I'd been a little bit less obsessed with everyone who kept telling me these early interventions, hurry, hurry, hurry. And I often felt a lot of that pressure. Whereas now that he's a teenager, obviously I'm still supporting him and scaffolding him and doing all these things, but I'm much more relaxed in a way, and I'm just loving who he is, and I'm much more connected to him, like laughing with him and just like his company and enjoying being with him without feeling so much pressure, because your child will evolve, they will develop. You can't rush these things, but you will miss that time if you don't connect with them, and accepting yourself as well, where you're at. I mean, that's one thing I do talk about, is really having to let go of a lot of the perfectionism and the pressure that we feel as women and parents generally, which is a work in progress. I'm not amazing at it. I'm trying. But yeah, that's what I would say.
There's a question we ask everyone at the end of the show. And of course, we're going to ask it to you. What is bliss for Julie Green?
Gosh, it's so hard to narrow down. I was thinking about this the other day because there's so many things hobby-wise I love to do. Like I loved painting and obviously music. Music is still very much the place where I'm there with my 80s music. And there's just something about listening to some of those songs. It connects me to like a childhood version of myself who was like free and not feeling shame, not judgmental. Well, I picture my original self dancing around to Cyndi Lauper, wearing a whole bunch of like my mom's costume, jewelry or clothes, and not having a care in the world. And obviously I don't dress up now, but if I go for a walk and I put on the 80s tunes, I'm in that spot. I'm in that place. Awesome.
When you come back with your next book, maybe you'll dress up like that for the interview. That'd be fun.
I should. Get out the leg warmers and neon. Here we go.
That's great. What is the best way for people to contact you, Julie, connect with you on social media, and of course, to get a copy of your book, Motherness?
Sure. Well, Motherness should be everywhere. You want to buy it. If it's not at your little local bookseller, it's obviously best if you can support the little local booksellers, but you can always ask them. They can order it in. Otherwise, it's Indigo, Amazon. A lot of chains have it. I am on Substack at The Autistic Mom, where I post every week. I'm on Instagram at juliem.green, and my web is juliemgreen.ca. And there's a bunch of stuff there, some interviews and old articles and things that I've written.
I want to thank you. Your book really did make me laugh and cry, especially the ending, guys. Oh my gosh. It's intense.
Thank you.
I really, really loved it. And it's been a real honor to have you on the program today.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for all the research and the close reading that you've done. That's quite satisfying for me as well. So I'm happy.
Thank you so much. Each week we spotlight a fabulous person like Julie M. Green, who is living their bliss. So if you're an author, artist, yoga, mindfulness, or meditation expert, or really anyone who has found and is following their bliss, we'd love to hear from you. We also love to feature singer-songwriters and musicians on the show. We love music here too. If you're a singer, please reach out to us. And are there any guests or topics you'd like us to feature on Finding Your Bliss? Write to us at fyb@findingyourbliss.com. For those of you who don't know, I'm also the Bliss Coach. That means I help you gain clarity, get unstuck, find your passion and purpose. Reach out to me at findingyourbliss.com/coaching. I'm also on Insight Timer, the number one free meditation app. And of course, you can always follow us at The Bliss Minute on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. Don't go anywhere. We're going to go on a short commercial break. When we come back, an artist who has inspired generations to embrace their true colors. She's a pop icon and a trailblazer known for her joyful spirit and the timeless message of being unapologetically herself, the one and only Cyndi Lauper. And for anyone who's missing this favorite 80s tune, here's Cyndi Lauper to sing us out of the show today with Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Be right back. Back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We're back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. And to close us out of the show today, here's a classic from the 80s, Girls Just Want to Have Fun, one of the favorite songs on author Julie Green's playlist. Let's all have a listen. I would like to thank our wonderful guest, Julie Green, for being on the show today. Also, thank you to Meg Ruffman, Siobhan Kiley, Lori Quinn, Olivia Vigiani, audio engineer Juliana Yannicello, senior editor Lauren Kaminsky, video editor Sierra Brown Rodriguez, audio producer Faz Kazi, and everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. Also, thank you to Garrett Flores for the gorgeous pink roses that adorn our set each week. For everyone here, I'm Judy Liebrack, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.